and welcome to Reality Check. This is Jeannie Allen. My guest today is a modern Renaissance man, a publisher, author, economist, businessman, columnist, and it turns out a documentary producer, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes. He was also a presidential candidate and much sought-after commentator on national affairs for years. Steve Forbes is probably best known as the publisher of the eponymous financial magazine Forbes. He's also the son of Malcolm Forbes, who was probably second only to Evel Knievel as a famous motorcycle rider. President Ronald Reagan appointed Steve chairman of the board for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. He helped create Governor Christine Todd Whitman's plan to cut New Jersey's income tax by 30%. Gosh, that's ancient history now, isn't it, Steve?
Which
was a major, right? Which was a major factor in Whitman being elected governor. Steve ran for the Republican presidential nomination in 1996 and 2000, emphasizing, among other things, a flat income tax, free trade, school choice, and local control of education. He has not slowed down a bit since then, and America's civic discussion is so much better because of that. Thank you so much for joining me, Steve.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it really is funny to think about ancient history, not just on tax cuts in states like New Jersey, but just in general, the slippery slope of so much of the civil discourse that I know that you have always been interested in. I penned a piece the other day about the citizenship test. Turns out people who are taking the citizenship test know a lot more than our students. And you have often talked about the kind of decline of education and the root of that. Tell us what you're thinking these days about education.
Well, what we see in government-run education is a prime example of what happens when you don't have effective accountability or competition or choice. And I think we're learning more and more that kids learn things in different ways. And you can have a perfectly good school in your neighborhood, but maybe right for one of your kids, but not quite right for another one of your kids. And when you don't have a real choice, then you get not only mediocrity, but you often get institutions that become more interested in their own well-being rather than their original mission. A good story on that in terms, and this is true of all organizations, if they don't have accountability, is a British historian, C. Northcote Parkinson. He wrote, this was back in the 1950s, he was writing a history of the British Navy. And he noticed after World War I, when everyone thought there'd never be a big war again, and Britain had the largest navy in the world, that Britain sharply downsized the navy, mothballing ships, laying off dock workers, discharging sailors. But he noticed that as the British Navy got smaller, the agency, government agency running the British Navy, got bigger. And he came to the conclusion that the size of an organization does not always necessarily relate to the work it is supposed to do. It'll just get bigger on its own. So getting back to education, I think we're learning now there are multiple sources of education. I think you're going to see a revolution in higher ed, led by what Mitch Daniels is doing at the University of Purdue, holding the line on tuition for 8 years now. I think you're going to see it, too, in more and more school choice, not through just political battles, but through what Uber did to the taxi cartels. High tech is going to do it. So high tech combined with homeschooling combined with people getting together as they did in the old days in this country to put together an education program. I think in the next generation, how we provide education in this country, which will be an example for other countries, is going to change dramatically and very much for the better.
Wow, you are so right and prescient on this. I mean, it's really interesting to think about while it's only really been about 25 years since sort of school choice opportunities started and began to push the envelope. The concept of choosing really has evolved into so much more sort of marketplace and consumer driven. And you're right, you've got Uber, you've got Airbnb. People can go online and take exceptional course from thousands of universities for free, MOOCs and things like that. My friend Steve Klinsky, who I'm sure you know, who started Modern States freshman year for free, is taking the country by storm completely out of the traditional apparatus or structures. But it is amazing, though, to go back to your point about government growing and the case about the British Navy, which compares so well to public education, Steve, why does it keep growing, though, when we actually more and more people are taking themselves out of the traditional run system?
Because there's nothing to stop it, effectively. You know the power of the education associations in each state, and woe betide the politico who gets in their crosshairs. And so most just opt, try to go along, get along. And so reforms are almost like rolling the proverbial stone up the hill, or trench warfare in World War One. You fight and fight and gain very little ground. And so there have been some big breakthroughs, Nevada, Arizona, and elsewhere. But the empire always strikes back. And that's why it's not just going to be pressure. It's going to be high tech that's going to change the thing.
Well, I've been fascinated watching ed tech move so far and fast beyond where we are now, everything from adaptive learning and understanding where kids are in real time to again, questioning the very basis of it. What makes eighth grade eighth grade? If we want kids to learn something, it may be that they can do two grades in 1 year. There's so many things that we can address that way. It kind of reminds me of your flat tax proposal years ago. Many people thought that that was novel and maybe a little crazy at the time, would you say?
It certainly was novel, and but since then, 35 countries around the world have adopted variations of the flat tax, and it's worked very well in the laboratory of real-life experience. On the school side, we always think that learning has to be kids who don't like to sit down, certainly boys, for very long. I think you're seeing experimentation there where instead of having six subjects in a day, maybe just have one subject in the day, English for the day, science for the day, and have immersion, you know, grade school versions of immersion. And we forget, too, with the philosophers in Greece, they often were walking around when they were discussing philosophy. So I think you're going to see a lot of different ways of teaching and realize that there's no one size fits all.
So the challenge, of course, which I would love your both advice and thoughts about, the challenge is how do you convince most people who went to school in the system that we have now, who often tell the polls, you know, when you see the surveys, you know, I like my school just fine. It's everybody else's schools that are bad. I mean, there really is this beyond the associations and the establishment you mentioned that stand in the way of transformation, I'd call it. There's kind of apathy or just a lack of information. It's as if we're kind of running in place on education. What can we do better to convince people that we have to change?
Well, I think you're seeing it with a lot of the schools you see in places like New York, the KIPP schools and others, where you focus on where clearly help is needed, clearly where the schools are not working. And so that way, parents will tell you in a lot of these communities, the schools are not working. So you go with the most visible problems, and then when you start to see success there, I think it's going to percolate outward where people say, well, you know, look what they did there with kids who on paper would have a very difficult time, and it's starting to work. And I think when you get that kind of choice and accountability and with high tech, you're going to see it's, again, starting with the colleges, people are going to start asking questions. I mean, until very recently, parents were under the assumption that if a college wasn't charging what Harvard and Princeton and Yale were charging, well, they must be an inferior institution. It's one of those things where the more expensive you are, well, they must be better. They're charging more. And I think you're starting to see a change on that, that indeed, high price doesn't mean you're getting a high-quality education. And we've seen real tuitions increase double. Sticker prices for higher ed, colleges and universities. And I don't think anyone with a straight face can say that the quality of the education has doubled in the last generation.
Right, right. And I wonder, you know, I wonder also when you think about the workforce and workforce needs and, look, higher learning and more learning of any sort are critical to our survival, right? They're critical to people who knowing something about their country, to being able to be great productive participants in the economy. But we have this problem where there's a disconnect between what students are learning oftentimes and the workforce, and businesses having the challenge of finding workers with the skills they need. Is there an either or? Can you actually combine both higher learning and workforce in your estimation? And what do we do about this seeming disconnect with the workforce and workers?
Well, I think as people start to ask more and more, what am I getting for the resources my parents and myself are putting into, that I'm putting into getting through college, they're going to demand, one, I think you're going to see a real push instead of 4 years or 6 years, a push to get it done in 3 years. So instead of 3 months off in the summer, you may have to only have 5 weeks off, but you get it done in 3 years, save yourself a bundle of money. Mm-hmm. And then I think you're going to see, in addition to that, I think you're going to see education having a more of a continuing character to it. So it's not going to be a rigid 3 year, 4 year. People are going to take courses that they find useful. And what you're starting to see happen is people are finding in terms of jobs that having a certificate of proficiency in a certain area, say of accounting, is going to start to count more and more among employers as saying, yeah, I need the skills in that area. You've demonstrated proficiency in it. I don't care whether you learned sociology or not. I know you can do the job here. You're hired. But it also is going to put, I think, good pressure on educators. Instead of relying on, oh, if you go to college, you'll have a better future, I think they're going to have to learn once again to defend humanities, liberal arts education, which is both science and the humanities, why this is good for you. And don't relate it to, oh, you'll earn 5% more a year. This makes you a better person, and they're going to have to make that case again.
I couldn't agree more, and I feel challenged oftentimes by the conversation about, again, sort of a, you know, you can do the liberal arts and humanities, or, you know, in the last presidential election when Marco Rubio said the famous line, which I was a little offended at because I'm a political philosophy person, he said philosophy or welding, and my question was, why not both?
Right. one doesn't preclude the other.
Right, exactly. You can do both, and maybe you don't have to do it at the same time, and maybe you can go into one field and then follow. But I don't want us going down a road where you suddenly see a student in 9th or 10th grade, and the very teachers and system that have not been able to keep up with modern ways of teaching, that don't hold kids to the highest expectations, go, you look kind of dopey. You're 9th or 10th grade, Steve. You're going to go over to shop class. Like, who makes that decision? We should provide pathways for families and students themselves to make those decisions.
Well, and the idea that you can tell at a young age what a kid's going to be able to do or not do is preposterous. You know, the British were very big on trying to separate you at 14. You're going to go here, you're going to go there. And we really don't know. Some kids thrive at a very early age. Others are truly late bloomers. And so if you haven't gotten your Nobel Prize by the age of 20, it does not necessarily mean the end of the world.
Exactly. Well, and I think that is an issue today. It's essentially, as you're saying, it's much more complex than we can figure out who should go into a work route and who should go, quote-unquote, to higher ed. And lots of talk about apprenticeships today on Capitol Hill, President Trump, Ivanka, Secretary DeVos, and I applaud the idea of learning as you go, but I agree with you. It can't be one route, and certainly not decided by the same government system that often fails our kids. And so I think that's a really great point. I'm really glad you raised it.
Well, the problem with government is it really takes what already exists. And politically, it's very difficult to do the kind of experimentation that you can do in the private sector. You know, you start a company, it fails. Well, that's you and the investors are out of luck. But in government, it either gets covered up or becomes a scandal, and so they stick with what they know. And progress, as we know, comes from things that we don't know exist until they're brought into existence. Imagine 25 years ago, bringing somebody back from the dead 20 or 25 years ago and explain the internet to them.
Gosh, I'm really glad you're still interested in talking about education, clearly keeping up on it, like the Purdue University issue, which is now Purdue Global, has people they're recruiting from all over the world. It's
exactly.
Just extraordinary. You got a new project, a documentary called In Money We Trust, that is going to be beginning to air in January on Maryland Public Television. What is that all about, Steve?
And I emphasize it's In Money We Trust, ? We know the history of money, and it's sometimes trustworthy, but oftentimes not. It's done, Maryland Public Television is the presenting station, and from Louis Rukeyser days, they've had an interest in this. So it'll start to syndicate over various stations. It'll be on, for example, Channel 13 in New York, WNET in January, and then percolate around the country. But what the documentary does is take the mystery out of money and point out that what money is, it's very simple, and when money is trusted, we prosper. Humanity moves ahead. When money is not stable, then not only do you not get the kind of material progress we would like, but also it has social consequences, bad social consequences, social trust. You see it most dramatically with a hyperinflation like the German hyperinflation of the early 1920s, which undermined people's faith and trust in democracy, and we saw where that led ultimately. Mm-hmm. And we see it today, a lot of the social tensions. John Maynard Keynes pointed out in hyperinflation, he said it puts the laws of economics on the side of destruction. He said not one person in a million understands what's happening. Well, you can have a slow motion version of that when money gradually loses its value. So it's social and economic. And we start with going back to a place called Lydia next to Athens. They first invented coins, and how Athens became a thriving philosophical and commercial center with sound money, how Rome had sound money and then destroyed it, and we saw what happened there, all the way up to the present with uncertainty about money. That's why Bitcoin is sort of a high-tech cry for help, but it's not yet money because it's unstable. Mm-hmm. So we take a very fascinating, quick journey, and no economic jargon. We are plain spoken, so people can get it. And
sounds like it's a must-watch for members of Congress and policymakers everywhere. What do you think?
Absolutely. And it's fascinating. You know, people doing things is always fascinating, and seeing how things unfolded here. How did Holland become a great global empire? How did Britain become an island, become a great global empire? How did we go from 13 colonies, subsistence agriculture on the East Coast to a globe-girdling economy? And a big part of it was having sound money. It's like weights and measures. You know, we assume 60 minutes in an hour, 12 inches in a foot. Imagine if we floated the clock. 60 minutes an hour one day, 30 minutes the next, we know it would be chaotic. But the same is true of money. Money measures value. It's not wealth. It measures wealth. It's a claim on products and services, like a claim check.
You know, it's so fascinating and a great reminder to hear you talk about that, and again, to think back to how we educate our nation's future leaders. This is not typically a subject that you'd see in most traditional schools or in most curriculum. And yet, doesn't it sound, it makes sense that this would be fundamental to if education and the systems that we create around it, albeit much more flawed than ever intentioned, were to help provide a pathway to being prosperous, successful, happy people. As the Founding Fathers envisioned, that this should be a core course.
It's very basic, and it's astonishing, given the history of this country, where, you know, even if you're on the frontier, out in the West, with no settlements, they always made sure they hired somebody to teach the kids, not only reading and writing and arithmetic, as they used to say, but also understanding what made America unique.
You know, your interest
in that.
What
we were all about.
Right. And your interest in that is reminiscent of the most recent book, I believe it was, which was published in 2015, entitled Reviving America. And I think the subtitle was something about repealing Obamacare, replacing the tax code, and reforming the Fed will restore hope and prosperity.
Yes.
And, you know, it was that's a wonderful to-do list in and of itself for the congressional GOP at that time, which is on its way out. Yet, despite majorities and a president who I presume would have been happy to sign bills that did just that, they failed. What went wrong, Steve?
What went wrong was, first of all, I blame the congressional Republicans for this one. They began by trying to reform health care, and they discovered very quickly it is a complicated subject. And the reason they started with health care was because under their crazy budget rules in Washington, they felt if they repealed and reformed Obamacare, that would free up more money for tax cuts. That's fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
They should have focused first on tax cuts. Forget what they call the Congressional Budget Office, which purports to tell you the impact of tax cuts over the next 10 years.
Right.
If the CBO knew what happened over the next 10 years, not to mention the next 10 days, nobody would work there. They'd be out buying lottery tickets or speculating in stocks and commodities. They knew what was going to happen in 10 years. But yet the Republicans handcuffed themselves on that. So they came across as starting to take away from you. And that's why the Democrats won control of the House. The Republicans were sitting on their hands when the Democrats went out and said, you have pre-existing conditions, or you have any relatives or friends of pre-existing conditions, you're going to be thrown out on the street. And the Republicans had no effective counter for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't united on what changes they wanted in health care, and they started off with the most difficult subject instead of going for a big fat tax cut, which would have given them the capital to tackle various parts of health care. So they did themselves in. And they did not respond to the Democrats when they said, Grandma, you know, you almost think that wheelchairs were invented to make it easier to get Grandma over the cliff.
Exactly. And it's sort of that same messed up maybe DNA that caused them to fail on even enacting something dramatic and different for higher ed. Their reauthorization for the way the federal government spends money in higher education was up. That didn't get done. Any kind of educational freedom or portability for federal funds and school choice didn't get done. And it just strikes me as a lost and missed opportunity across the board. I wonder if you look back and go, gosh, I ran for president. Had I been there, I would have done better.
One always thinks so. One would have done far better, of course. But I think one thing I would have pushed for is the fundamental simplification of the tax code combined with tax cuts, which is a huge source of power and corruption in Washington, the complex code, stable money, so we don't have the kind of malaise we have today, much
mm-hmm.
more prosperity. And on the tax thing, you know, if you look back at 20 years, IRS estimates we spend 6 billion hours a year filling out tax forms. We spend, experts tell us, $200 to $300 billion a year complying with this monstrosity that nobody understands. Go back 20 years, Jeannie, and imagine if all those resources, brain power, time, had been spent creating new products, new services, new medical devices, new cures for diseases, how much better off we'd be today. Huge opportunity costs, as the economists would say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we'd have done far, far better there. And on education, pushing real choice, freedom. You know, we're not all the same. And entitlements, you know, there are two approaches to entitlements. One is root canal without anesthesia approach, you know, raising retirement age to 85 or something like that, or the more positive one where you get the patient in control of health care again. That not only gives you end up with more health care, as we see with food, which is more basic than health care, but also in a more affordable manner. Mm-hmm. And then Social Security, have a new system for younger people. Don't mess it with it for those who are on it today. Realize that system's baked in, but have a new system coming in for younger people where they own their own accounts. You have sensible rules and regulations so they don't go using the money on racehorses or something. But you have these personal accounts. Somebody in their teens or 20s, by the time they retire, not only will they get far, far more, even if they just buy bank CDs, not only will they have far more in their retirement account, but they can choose their age at which they wish to retire or semi-retire, mm-hmm. again, instead of one size fits all. So they're positive approaches. And I think even if we didn't get all of it done, we certainly would have set the ground for vigorous debate about the proper approach. And that's how ultimately you change minds.
Exactly. And exactly what you're talking about resonates with younger people all the time today. They don't understand why they have to join certain systems. And I do think maybe there's hope with that amazing vision that you've laid out since you became very public with your work, even outside of Forbes and in your presidential runs. In fact, one of my sons, who was very young then, who happens to be one of the producers for the show, when you were speaking, and he was very young, said, "Mom, I really like Steve Forbes and that flat tax." And he was like 8 years old, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, out of the mouths of babes, if we could just look at things as simply as younger people and not be clouded by all the other considerations and conceit, what a better world we would have, right?
I think so. That's why we got to keep fighting.
So I am so excited you have been my guest. If you are just tuning in, I have been talking to the amazing Renaissance man, Steve Forbes. Steve, one final question for you. I ran for, you know, the little teeny Maryland House of Delegates about 8 years ago and found that campaign to be consuming and exhausting. I can't imagine a presidential campaign. What was your biggest takeaway from that experience?
Well, other than it's more fun to win than to lose, and but you do learn about the country in a way you never do, you know, visiting as on business or as a tourist, and you realize despite all the junk out there, the cultural junk out there, that this is still a very strong country. So I came away encouraged. Yeah, I was not encouraged by the result, but certainly the country itself is stronger than people realize, which gives me hope that if we just make some positive changes, we'll get stronger still in the future.
Well, it is indeed the greatest country on earth and made more so by people like yourself who are willing to step out, be so informed, so articulate, so thoughtful, and so active. So I thank you, Steve Forbes, for being my guest today. And I want to make sure that I remind everyone who's listening on Reality Trek that Steve has a documentary coming out in January, and we will be sure to promote it as well, not just in the podcast now and in the future, but at edreform.com. It's called In Money We Trust? On Maryland Public Television and all around on public television. Thank you so much, Steve, for joining us, and I wish you the happiest of holidays.
You too, Jeannie. Thank you. Thank you for what you do.
Appreciate it.
Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced in partnership with National Review Online. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe wherever podcasts are available, including iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And follow us at EdReform on Twitter and myself at Jeannie Allen. For more information or to learn more about the topics you heard today, go to edreform.com.